Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Reese D. was very gracious in accepting a last-minute invitation. We had another fellow, which we will be bringing to the podium in the future soon, but he had a conflict. Anyway, I think I've asked Reese a dozen times. I've known him about 7 years, maybe. I can tell you, about 4 years ago, I had just had surgery and had a tumor removed, a stage 4 cancer tumor. The second day in my recovery there, Reese came to see me, and he came back more than once that week. And I had to, like, walk around the floor, and this is a busy man. And he would come in, and I know it took him 45 minutes to walk me around the hospital floor. And that's just the kind of guy he is. I think there's 23 or more guys that came down from Gainesville to support Reese in telling this story tonight. And that's on a last-minute notice. That's the kind of guy he is. I'm very proud to call him my friend. And please come up, Reese.
For short people, I'm Reese Daniel, alcoholic. Hey, everybody. And I will acknowledge that the NAVA's charter provides that meetings here are singleness, the purpose of recovery from alcoholism. And I have a desire to stop drinking. And I have for a long time. Sobriety date 6-5, June 5th, 1982. And my story contains alcohol, drugs, sex, you know, just those kind of things. Food, you know, all that stuff, all that good stuff. And but I won't tell y'all all. You know, if in the big book it says our liquor was but a symptom. And that's what it meant to me. I mean, think about that. If I would have known what that really meant when I got in recovery, I'd have been scared to death to know what I know today. Because it was what it meant to me, and what it means to me now is my drinking was just hiding things that I needed to be paying attention to. And I was born in South Georgia, Brunswick, down there. And my life started out difficult, confusing, and all those things. But I can't tell you it was confusing. I didn't know that until I got in recovery. My mom was Jewish, and my dad was whatever. You know, he went to church once, I think. And but bringing a Jewish lady from New York to South Georgia in the 50s, It was not good. I mean, we were picked on all the time, and we didn't even go to synagogue or anything. But just people would hear they're Jewish. You know, it's kind of a secret thing. And my grandparents hated my dad. They loved my dad, but they hated that he brought a Jewish woman from New York to South Georgia. You know, because it was embarrassing to them. So it just shows you right off the bat what I'm dealing with. My early life was filled with a lot of abuse, you know, physical, sexual, you know, those kind of things. And I mean early life. And and y'all, when it happens long enough, you come to think that it's normal. And, you know, when I got in recovery, I can remember doing my fourth step, and this was the fifth time in recovery. And I remember doing my fourth step, and I just said it all, did my fourth step and said it all. It didn't affect me at all. And the reason it didn't affect me is because I've become numb to it. You know, it was such a normal part of my life that I had become numb to it. Little did I realize, after a little time in recovery, that was what I was going to have to deal with. You know, all that abuse and stuff like that. When I first got in recovery, you know, step 6 and 7 have been very, very important in my life. And the reason they have been is because of character defects. I am loaded with character defects. I got 33 years in recovery, and I can still participate very well in my character defects. And, you know, one of the things that I came to realize, and you know, it's funny, I realized this early on, but I still can hear the voices in my head sometimes telling me that I'm not good enough. I'll never be good enough. I'll never amount to anything. You know, those kind of things. And that's what I mean, our liquor was about a symptom. That's what it was covering up for me, all those feelings that I didn't want to feel. And I did not like my mom. My mom was extremely abusive. She was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I was that kid at an early age that said, I will never be like my mom. Never. And I wasn't. I was a lot worse than my mom ever thought about being. And y'all, I hated my mom. I still don't like her that much. She's still alive. Because she's still not a happy person. But I can't control that today. I can do what my part is and all that, and that's calling her regular. I pay her bills, not with my money, but I pay her bills for her, you know, because she can't do a lot of those things anymore. So I try to be helpful and give back to what she did give to me. Because my mom did give me some good things. I don't want people to hear that it was all negative, because she did. She taught me how to cook. Taught me how to wash my clothes, taught me different things like that, that it came in handy when I got in recovery and got out on my own. I was, you know, a drug user at an early age. I drank. I loved to drink. I loved drugs, and I loved women. And I loved those things. And you know what was funny? My wife asked me after we got married, this was a long time ago, she said, what do you miss the most about being single? And I said, now that's a heck of a question. And I said, well, I miss the women. And she said, well, what do you mean like that? I said, you know, it's funny. I miss that chase. Same thing I did with drugs, that chase. Same thing I did, you know, when I would go get a fix. I miss that. And she said, so what do you miss the most? I said, the interaction, the chase, the things like that. And I said, and you know the funny thing about it is I never caught that many women. You know, that was all in my head. You know, it really was. I was a whole lot better in my head than I really was in real life, or hoped that I wanted to be. Anyway, I was the kind of person that in the 10th grade, my dad sent me to a private school. Now, I'm going to say it like that, sent me to a private school. It was the first year it was open. I'm the first person got kicked out of the private school. And the reason, what would happen is my dad cut my hair. Now, what was that, 10th grade, 16 years old, 15 years old, 1970 right then. My dad would cut my hair. And what he would say was, if you would pass, you could grow your hair long. And he cut my hair. And it made me mad, so I didn't pass. And he cut my... So we kept. It just shows you the kind of mentality I had back then, you know, the kind of thinking I had. And the loser, y'all, was always me. You know, but I was going to show him, you know, that kind of thing. And that just goes back to what my thinking was. My thinking was kind of screwy. Anyway, at 17, I got hepatitis for the first time. And the reason I say that is because I was easily influenced, and I put myself in positions I didn't need to be. It was an IV, you know, hepatitis. And y'all, I was at that stage in my recovery that I didn't have to use every day, and I saved up a bunch of drugs and alcohol. I had them all up under the waterbed. Some of y'all remember waterbeds? Yeah. Young people probably don't. Yeah. but I put all, and I had a coming out party. You know, it was just that kind of thing that I would save, and I would save and do all those things. Anyway, I went to treatment for the first time. And let me tell y'all about my first treatment, because y'all appreciate this. And his first name was Howard. And Howard was a counselor in Brunswick. And Howard worked for the mental health system. My parents, we got to get Reese help for his drugs. And I was 17 or 18, I can't remember which one, and so every week I'd go see Howard. Now, Howard loved to smoke pot, So we would go talk about my drug and alcohol problems while we were smoking pot. And everybody needs a counselor like that. You know, it's a... but it didn't work for me, y'all. I didn't get in recovery. But I will tell y'all what I remember. I remember they brought a speaker in, and he was a recovering heroin addict, an alcoholic. And I never forgot where he talked about he got recovery. Never forgot about it. My first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in Georgia Regional Hospital in Savannah, and not as a worker, but as a patient. And, you know, back then, y'all, they used to give you Valium to withdraw, you know, from the alcohol and the drugs and stuff. And they, you know, the other guys, you know, I'd bring liquor in and they would trade me their Valium for, you know, the liquor and, you know, stuff like that. But, y'all, the miracle when, as I got in recovery, I started realizing the things that God was doing for me, what I couldn't do for myself. So I'm in the, and they take us to an AA meeting inside. You know, they won't let you out because it's a locked facility. And here comes walking in these six or seven people, and one of them was the head narcotics officer from Brunswick. Now, two things went through my head. One is, are they here for me? That's how my ego was. You know, are they here for me? And, y'all, he was there to lead an AA meeting. And it was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, was the head narcotics agent. And it was really, he knew me. I mean, and I don't mean he had arrested me, but he knew me. And, you know, so it was interesting. Back then, I couldn't understand the impact of what was happening at that time. It took me a little while to get to a place that I could. It wasn't too much longer that my dad, we had a cemetery, and he brought, this guy's brother died, and he brought this guy over, and this guy 12-stepped me. Now, I was still about 18 years old, but these are all the little things that were happening that were, for me today, was God doing for me, you know, because I never forgot this guy. His Hilton Logue was his name. And, y'all, this is 40 years later, and I still remember that man, you know, for coming over, for taking the time to come over and take me to meetings. Now, I did not take it seriously, and, you know, in the big book it talks about if the person that you're working with does not take this thing seriously, move on to the next. And he moved on to the next. Always remembered me, and he'd come talk to me anytime he saw me on the farm and everything. I went through several treatment centers, and in 1982, 81, I went to treatment for the last time I was in treatment, and it was down in Statesboro, and it was at Willingway Hospital, and, you know, I would love to tell you that I got in recovery, but what I did do for a change, because I had nowhere to live anymore, and my dad had made sure of that because he'd got me out of jail so many times that he finally said, I can't keep doing this. And so I went up there, and of course, what do I do in treatment? You know, because I take this treatment stuff seriously. I met a woman. And I met this woman and her husband. I didn't know she was married at first, but her husband came to family week and brought pot with him. And so that started a relapse for me, and I had a major overdose, and that was June 5th, 1982. And y'all, my thinking was so insane at that time. I was so terrified, and I didn't realize how terrified, except when I was without alcohol or without drugs. You know, and when I was a raving maniac. You know, in the big book, it talks several times about that I am willing to go to any length to stay in recovery. And then I think about what Ryan read. It said, if we are painstaking, you know, about this phase of our development. Now, this time in 1982, when I finally got in recovery on June 5th, I didn't want to be the way I had been for so long. I was 25 years old, and I did not want to be that way anymore. My ego was such that I probably had at least three sponsors the first year, and I would love to tell you that it was because I was growing and I was doing all these things, but it was because the first one was a circuit speaker, the next one was a higher up in a company, and the next one was just a very well-liked guy. And I was doing it for me, for what you would think about me. And that started showing me the pattern of my life, is I was more worried about what you thought about than what I was thought of, that I thought about me. And it took me a long time to get to a place that I had some comfort with who I am. A long time. I was extremely resentful when I got in recovery. I didn't know how resentful I was. I hated everything and everybody. And, you know, in the big book it says we ceased fighting everything and everyone. And it took me a long time to get to that place. I was in Statesboro. I was living there. I was doing, you know, basically I was doing what Reese wanted to do. But there were some things that were consistent this time. And one of them was prayer. You know, one of the things, I did not believe in God. I didn't believe that, you know, in a higher being at all. But one of the things that the guy told me, one of the first sponsors, was just pray. Just pray. And he kept saying it, just pray. And at about 4 months in recovery, I had a spiritual awakening. Now, it wasn't this major, overwhelming white light and everything. It was a garden of the, what is it? Garden variety, who? Yeah. You know, I had this spiritual awakening, and all it was, y'all, was there is a God. That's it. There is a God. It was tough for me for a long time, because when you grow up in the South, especially far south as I did, you know, the Bible Belt and everything, there's expectations of how you're supposed to believe in God. And that was really tough on me, especially growing up the way I did. But, you know, it seemed like everybody wanted me to be a Christian and have a Christian God. And it was funny that one of my next door neighbor, who was a Christian when I was growing up, he used to walk around and say one way and all that stuff. And, you know, two things. One, I admired him because of his thinking, you know, that he was willing to put himself out there. The other was that when I got in recovery, I took a copy of the big book to him. I'd been in recovery about a year when his brother died. And I took a copy of the big book to him, and I asked him, because I needed acceptance. And that's me. I was just needy. And I needed acceptance. And he called me on the phone, which I think is the only time I've talked to him in all these years. And he said, that's the most profound pieces of literature I've ever read. And this is a guy that doesn't have an alcohol, doesn't use, doesn't drink, doesn't do anything to say that. And as time went by, I did the normal things that you do when you get in recovery. If you take something out of your life, I put something back in my life. So what I ended up doing was I took alcohol and drugs out of my life. So I started caffeine, lots of cigarettes, and the girls, you know, that kind of stuff. I could not stay out of the women's halfway house. I couldn't stop. And y'all, it was one of those things that I'd love to tell you that it was just part of my thinking that you would say, I'm just not going to do that anymore. But I could not do that. The same way with my drugs and with my alcohol. I just could not do that. And so what happened was I had about 3 months in recovery. And you know that old saying about a year without emotional involvement? Well, they told me that, but one of the counselors at the hospital I worked at evidently thought I was cute. She had about 3 years in recovery, and so she sought me out. And y'all, it was sick. I moved up to Atlanta to live with her because she moved up to Atlanta. I followed her up here, and we almost got married. We were engaged, getting ready to get married. And I'll tell you a little bit about that story in just a minute, if I remember. If you ever listen to AA talks, when people say, I'll tell you about that in a minute, a lot of times we forget. So the thing that remained consistent with me is that I continue to go to meetings. And I'd love to say, and I want to say something else. When you were walking in and that young fellow was sitting out front greeting people, Derek, good job, wherever you are. That's one of the things that my sponsors always said to me is, everybody smoked in AA back then, clean the ashtrays, put the chairs up, and greet people coming and going. And y'all, that's what they demanded of you, or of me, let me say that. And maybe it was because they thought I was sicker. Yeah, that's what happens sometimes. But a lot of people thought that stuff, you know, and I think that even myself, I don't see that as much as I used to, of, you know, the people sticking around to help clean up and do stuff like that. I continued with the women. The women, after a year, I quit drinking caffeine and I quit smoking. And all I had left in my life, y'all, was two things, Alcoholics Anonymous and women. And I'd love to tell you that the latter went away and I started getting healthier and all that stuff pretty quick, but I didn't, because I was so insecure. I was so afraid to let y'all see who I really was, that I had to put other things around me. You know, I use the analogy that, like, I had a lead jacket on me and I had this hook right here, and any time I had a compulsion, you know, the physical allergy and the craving, and y'all, it could be about anything. Every time I had it, this hook would go in and somebody would start turning this winch and it would pull me and I wouldn't be able to say no. And by the time I probably had 4 or 5 years, I felt so weak, terribly weak. And y'all, what I was doing in recovery was I was doing everything I could to make you think how healthy I was. If you looked on the outside, it looked really good. But I was kind of like that duck that looks all nice and calm on the lake and he's paddling like hell underneath. You know, and that was me. And because I was so terrified to let people know who I really was. The funny thing was, I didn't even really know who I was. So I started doing stuff after I moved to Jacksonville for a geographical cure. And in the process of all this, y'all, all this sex stuff that I told y'all early on that happened when I was a little kid, it started coming up. And it had to be dealt with. And so I had to start dealing with it. And it was tough stuff. I mean, it was stuff that most people would say, you know, it was sexual identity stuff. It was cravings. It was everything. And it was very, very hard for me to deal with. And to the point of almost killing myself, you know, because I don't want to do this. I don't want to have to do this. But something continued to remain consistent was Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to meetings and I had sponsor. When I moved up to Atlanta, I moved in with the girl I was telling y'all about. And y'all, I really did like her. I mean, I loved her. I wanted to marry her. I wanted my mind, all it could picture was a white picket fence and peace and happiness. You know, because that's what I'd craved my whole life, was peace and happiness. So I moved in with her. We were getting married. We got the invitations done and we'd done that. And finally, I had gotten to the place in recovery that it was very hard for me not to be honest. You know, the first principle is honesty. But it was very hard for me not to be honest about stuff. So I sat her down one day and told her the truth about what was going on with me, with all this, with all my thinking and everything. And she said, couldn't you have told me before we ordered the invitations? Because invitations were expensive. So, y'all, the person that I was involved with, she was my mom without the physical part of it. But the thing that I have to remember, y'all, is it was me that attracted her. So if she had stuff she was dealing with, I had stuff that I was dealing with. Because I don't want to put a lot of responsibility on her. You know, I can sit back and say, she was sick and she was this, she shouldn't have done that. You know, I can say that. But this woman turned out to be the catalyst for what changed my life. Anyway, we didn't last but about another month or something like that. And of course, you know how I do. You know, you go back, you can't leave. You go back, you leave. You go back, you leave. You're thinking that it'll happen this time. She's the one. And y'all, it never did. We even our friends at Biscayne Room and Skyland, they were all saying, y'all need to get apart. And I just, you know, it was almost impossible to do. But the thing that happened to me was I was sitting in the apartment where we lived in Stone Mountain. And I had a motorcycle. And I remember this, that I picked the motorcycle helmet up. Now, I had nowhere to go, and said, I'm leaving. And that was it. I left. And I called a friend and went and moved in with him in a one-bedroom apartment. It, you know, that began the start of my life, because what happened, y'all, was I ended up getting so despondent because I finally had to deal with all those resentments that I was telling y'all about at the first. All of them came up, except for one. And when I had about 7 years in recovery, I was standing in the car. I invited my mom up. Now, I told you what I think about my mom. I invited my mom up to visit in wherever I lived. Shambly. And I asked her to come up and visit. And so she came up, and I cooked her dinner. You know, I did all that stuff I'm trying to impress. And I stood over the sink, and I put some water in my mouth, and I rinsed it out, and I spit in the sink. Now, my house is a little kid. That you got beat for that. And she looked at me, and she said, "Why did you do that?" And I said, "Because I can." Now you know I got a resentment. And that was the start of, with the breakup of the relationship and that issue with my mom, that was really the pinnacle of everything. Now, y'all, I want to tell y'all that I was doing lots of things, so you would look at me like, "Wow, isn't he the coolest?" And I was dying inside. I was doing sweat lodges. I went out to this place for 16 days in California to learn all about Course in Miracles. I was doing all this stuff just so you would say, "Isn't that the coolest thing?" And y'all, what I was doing was searching for God. You know, and I, you know, in that song, "Searching for Love in All the Wrong Places," you know, I could say I was searching for God in all the wrong places, but they really were all the right places. It's the thing that finally got me to a place of enough pain that I wanted to be different. The one thing that was concealed that I couldn't stop, and it ended up being just like my drugs and alcohol, was the women. And y'all, I left Shamley one night about 8 or 9 o'clock, and I went up to Gainesville. This is before I lived in Gainesville. And I went to have sex with this girl, and I left there crying. And what I was crying about was it wasn't working for me anymore. And y'all, that was the first time in my life that the whole slate had been clean, everything, that nothing was working for me. Our liquor was but a symptom. You know, I came face to face with Reese. And I had some major work. Now, one of the great things about it was I had one of the best sponsors around. Now, he went to the other program and everything, but he was one of the best sponsors that I could have ever had. One of the most maternal men that I'd ever met, and he was till this day. And it was exactly what I needed. It was, you know, it's again one of those things, realizing God's doing for me what I can't do for myself. And he and I became best friends. We rode motorcycles all over the Southeast, and, you know, we did that stuff. But in doing that stuff, we spent time with each other. And the thing that always scared me about men, y'all, and most people, well, that's not fair. A lot of men, especially me, would say things, "It's just easier for me to talk to women." You know, it wasn't easier. I was scared to talk to guys. I was scared because of what had happened to me as a kid. I might have feelings about and have to deal with this stuff. And it was terrifying to me. And so getting this guy in my life, and then right after that, a woman came in. This was a lesbian, and we had the best relationship, you know, that you could have. Well, not sexual. we had the best relationship, but it was what I needed in my life. And it was so funny, y'all, that, and I've learned this in recovery, is the healthier I get, the healthier the people are around me. And it's amazing how that happens. And it doesn't mean that the people that I sponsor, that I don't get reminded time and time and time again about me, you know, about my thinking and about what got me to the place that I'm at. It took a long time, you know, for me to realize and to understand why sponsorship was so important. I knew why it was important to me, you know, because you're helping me. And, you know, I am the most important person, you know, and that's the way my mind thought. But it wasn't until later when I really understood what giving back meant. You know, and it talks in here about giving of ourselves selflessly. And, you know, and, y'all, I wish I could tell you I did that all the time. I don't. I wish I could tell you that I was close to perfect with 33 years. I'm not. You know, and one of the things that I know, that if I would have sought my recovery the way I sought my drugs and alcohol, I probably would have been a lot further along. Because, again, it says, if we're painstaking, you know, that's not, well, if I feel good about this. I didn't feel good a lot about a lot of things. And I quit dating women for a while. And I'd love to say that it was that thing that somebody said, you know, don't have an emotional involvement. It was, and it just said it wasn't working for me anymore. And I just didn't have any feelings out of it. And so not long, I can't tell you how long, it could have been a year, it could have been two, I met a lady up in Gainesville. I'd moved up to Gainesville at that time, and y'all, she was incredible. And what I mean by that is, this was a lady that I just happened to run into her, and it was interesting that she worked in public relations, and I had a different person over our account, and all of a sudden they put this lady over our account, and I met her, and I was terrified. I was terrified because I wanted to ask her out, and when I have no buffers, when most of the symptoms are cleared out, I didn't know how to say, "Would you like to go out on a date?" See, I mean, that's pretty easy, but it was not easy. And it took me about 6 or 7 months to ask that question. And the only way I asked it was, you know, time went by, and I saw her at a Christmas party, and she was wearing, I mean, I can tell you what she was wearing, you know, to this day. And I finally got enough nerve to ask her out. And she had two daughters. One was, I think, 4 or 5, and one was just turning 3. And, you know, the 3-year-old had never really known her dad. Her dad, he just wasn't a good guy. I mean, he was a nice guy, but he was very lost. And he still hadn't been found. But, you know, he was very lost. And so the 3-year-old attached to me. And y'all, I had always wanted kids. And one of the things that my wife today wouldn't do was she never introduced me to her kids until we'd been dating about 6 or 7 months. She would not let me see him. She was smart enough to say, my kids will get attached to him, and he'll get attached to them, and then it won't be about us. And so, I mean, right there, I'm telling you that the person that I was involved with was thinking pretty good. I can't see. Okay, we've got 2 hours left. So, anyway, the 6-year-old was, y'all, she hated me. I mean, hated everything about me. And what she hated was that they had been together 4 years without a man. And here this man was coming into their lives. And, y'all, she spit on me. She threw food at me. She did all these things. And it was God-awful. And I'm sitting dying inside thinking, I love this woman, but I hate this kid. So anyway, I mean, I was to this point of saying, I can't do this. We were sitting in the Waffle House. She had already spit food on me. And anyway, I was just defeated. And I walked out the door, and I'm getting ready to get in my car, and this little girl comes up to me, and she, out of her overalls, out of this pocket, she pulled a rock, because she knew how important rocks were to me. She pulled this rock, and y'all, it was a rock off a playground. But it was that important to her to give to me. It was kind of like a peace offering. And so what happened as a result of that, we got married, my wife and I did, and when we moved in together, in the first year, my 6-year-old, or 7, whatever she was at that time, I was angry. I was mad at her. And not about any of that old stuff. And let me tell y'all what I was mad at her about. You know, I married 87, I think. So I'd been in recovery about 14 or 15 years. And what I was mad about, because my wife said stuff like, you're fighting with a 6-year-old. You know, and I was having these feelings. And y'all, what I finally came to realize about this little girl was she was me as a 6-year-old. Needy, insecure, emotional, and dishonest. And that was me. Those are the reasons I got beat as a kid. And impulsive, because I was extremely impulsive. And when I finally realized that, It was a spiritual awakening. It was one of those things. It was one of those gifts from God that I finally realized my part in this. You know, I'm fighting with a 6-year-old, and there wasn't any reason to. What I was looking for, y'all, was to make somebody love me, like my mom was trying to do us. Make you're going to love me. I'll buy you stuff. I'll make you love me. Anyway. You know, we got married, and it was a good wedding. And, y'all, I have, by far, my opinion, the best wife ever. And you know what I think is, and I don't know what God's will is for anybody. I really don't. But I wish everybody could have a relationship. It doesn't matter, male, female, whatever, like I do with my wife. And, you know, the way that I look at a lot of things today is that everything was just a rung on a ladder. And it was just moving up, getting closer to God. And I can't imagine, you know, if I live another day, what's in store for me. I'd love to tell y'all that, and I've been successful and in a lot of areas. And the one thing that I'd love to tell you is a lot of my problems today are a higher quality of problems. But don't ever let the quality of your problems make you think that they can't lead you back to a drink again. I've seen people drink over the most stupidest things, and they're stupid to me, but not to them. And I have to remember that. And, you know, I got a job in February, and y'all, this has been the hardest job that I've ever had. And part of the reason it's been so hard is because I'm doing stuff I don't know how to do. And I'm insecure about it. It's bringing all those feelings up. The healthier part of me today realizes that I will get through it. And I can't tell you I'll still be working after I get through it, but I will get through it. And that's what track record shows me. And that's why going to Alcoholics Anonymous is so important to me, is because if I go in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am going to hear something I need to hear. I am. I'm going to see somebody in there. You know, the neat thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you can find anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that's been through what you're going through. Anybody. I've never seen it fail. And the good thing about it today, y'all, is my ego's not that big to where I have to think I know all the answers. I wish I did, because that would make me look better, but I don't know all the answers. I don't know what you need to stay in recovery. I know what I need today, and I need y'all. And y'all, I don't care if it's your first meeting here today. You know, one of the things that we say in our group, and maybe y'all say it here, is the most important person in the room is the newcomer. You know, and if I can always try to remember to remain a newcomer, I think I'll do okay. You know, I think I will. And it goes back to, again, if we're painstaking. And y'all, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love recovery. And you know, the funny thing about it, I'd love to tell y'all that my mind thinks that way all the time. But y'all, I can go out during my meditation. I can go out and my mind will start talking to me and saying, you know, is there really a God? You know, if there was a God, you know, it'll start talking to me. But I have choice today. My choice is, what am I going to do about it? I have the power today to talk in a different way. And I don't mean tongues. I mean talk in a different way and hear different things out of my head. And y'all gave me that gift. Y'all told me how to do those things. And I'm grateful for that. In these last few months in this job that's been so difficult for me, the things that I have done is what y'all have taught. Now, this is with time. The things that y'all told me to do at the very first is pray. Reach out to people. You know, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I forget that sometimes, because if I get so wrapped up in myself like I do, I forget. And I want to think about me. So I appreciate y'all, Tim, asking me to come down here and talk. I appreciate y'all being here tonight. And thank y'all.
Thank you very much, Reese, for being here and sharing your story with us.
There's a lot of news going round. People needing, but they doing without. While others living high, a big piece of the pie, so many they got it wrong. Ask for me. myself, hide it from everyone else, save it for a rainy day.
Time.